Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember when you were a kid and the neighborhood bully made you hand over your lunch money and told you not to tell? That's kind of what Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis says about buying Merrill Lynch, that Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson made him do it, and they said he couldn't tell anybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear unique perspectives on global events and American culture at AmericanPublicMedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It is the 23rd of April, but we are going to go back in time a little bit today to last December and a meeting between Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, and then Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. They were discussing B of A's pending acquisition of Merrill Lynch. Lewis was apparently having second thoughts about the deal because, according to testimony from Lewis that was released today by New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, Paulson and Bernanke leaned on him pretty hard to get with the program. So far, it's very much a yes, you did, oh, no, I didn't story. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that what was said is part of a much bigger issue.
If Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke really told the CEO of Bank of America to keep quiet about losses at Merrill Lynch, they were probably breaking the law. That's according to Lynn Turner, former chief accountant at the SEC.
If these allegations are proven true, both Bernanke and Paulson should be prosecuted by the SEC to the fullest extent of the law.
Paulson told investigators that he threatened to have Ken Lewis fired, but he didn't instruct Bank of America to withhold material information. Ken Lewis says he did. This isn't the only time officials have allegedly pressured companies concerning SEC disclosures. Regulators reportedly leaned on Freddie Mac executives not to reveal that an administration foreclosure prevention program could cost the company $30 billion. John Coffey, a securities expert at Columbia University, says there's an inherent problem when firms are privately run in name only.
I'm afraid that that produces these very difficult kinds of shadow governance regimes.
And pressures on management to do things government wants. Things like preventing foreclosures or stopping financial meltdowns, which is why Coffey says,
at the same time, we need an independent agency that will protect investors and try to make certain that they do get full and fair disclosure.
That agency is supposed to be the SEC. But when regulators pushed Bank of America to buy Merrill Lynch, the SEC was kept in the dark. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Corporate profit reports have moved on from the banks. It's technology and transportation this week in kind of a mixed bag. Apple said late yesterday iPhone sales drove a 15% jump in profits. This morning, though, bellwether UPS reported its earnings were down by more than half. And after the close today, Microsoft disappointed, too. So we asked Marketplace's Amy Scott, which it is, good economic news or bad?
Some analysts call the recent stock rebound a relief rally, as in investors are relieved things aren't as bad as they feared. Apple, eBay, Intel, and a handful of banks are just a sampling of the companies reporting better-than-expected earnings. Charles Lieberman is chief investment officer with Advisors Capital Management. He says some companies, including Apple, are notorious for setting low expectations so they can exceed them.
But when you're at a turning point in the economy, as I think we are, expectations and reality can deviate very, very widely.
Lieberman happens to think the market has truly bottomed. Stephen Wood is more in the relief rally camp. He's a strategist with Russell Investments. Wood says overall earnings are down for the seventh quarter in a row, but their rate of decline is slowing, and investors don't seem so worried the entire economy is going to collapse.
I think we've gone from, you know, this rampant systemic worries to more appropriate longer-term worries about specific corporate performance in a specific quarter.
But a specific company's earnings don't tell us a whole lot about where the wider economy is headed. Fred Dixon is chief strategist with D.A. Davidson & Company.
The information coming out really gives us kind of a very near-term rear window picture of what's happened and also what may be coming up in the next half mile to 1 mile in the economy. Past that, there's still a lot of question marks.
For Dixon, the big question mark is when people will start buying stuff again, beyond iPhones, that is. He says we may get a glimpse when retailers start reporting their quarterly earnings next month. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Those reports you might have heard yesterday that General Motors is going to shut down 9 plants temporarily, they were wrong.
General Motors today announced that it's going to idle 13 U.S. assembly plants between May and July, and I guess the goal is to cut 190,000 units out of their production schedule.
Auto analyst Marianne Keller says the move is probably a good one, despite or maybe because of the rumors of GM's impending demise.
This is not the end of General Motors. I mean, the end of General Motors would be if the company were not planning to finally come to grips with its, you know, decades-long problems.
Later this afternoon, the White House knocked down a rumor that Chrysler bankruptcy is imminent. Big Pharma is putting its money where its mouth is. Today, the drug maker Merck announced a new pricing deal with health insurer Cigna. Merck says it's going to adjust the price of its two diabetes drugs based on whether patient health actually improves. Joel Rose reports now on pharmaceutical pay-for-performance.
Traditionally, drug companies offer discounts based on how often their drug is prescribed, not how well it actually works. The deal announced today between Merck and Cigna is different.
Because it drives the right end results from all perspectives.
Eric Elliott is president of Cigna Pharmacy Management. He says Merck will charge Cigna less for two diabetes drugs, Januvia and Janumet, but only if patients get their blood sugar under control.
Health plan will benefit from overall medical outcomes, and the individuals will benefit from better outcomes for themselves.
And Merck stands to profit from the deal, too, even though it's cutting prices. Fiona Scott Morton teaches economics at the Yale School of Management. She says that's because Merck is counting on selling a lot more pills.
If an insurance company will really get aggressive in making sure their patients take the drug and get the refills for the drug, then the quantity I sell to that insurance company is going to go up. In addition, the people who are supposed to be taking the drug are, in fact, actually taking it.
The healthcare industry is experimenting with other kinds of pay-for-performance deals. Procter & Gamble just announced what's essentially a money-back guarantee on its new osteoporosis drug, Actinel. Dan Hecht manages P&G's pharmaceutical business in North America.
We're standing behind our product if somebody's been taking Actinel for at least 6 months, and if they suffered from a fracture, we would reimburse for the cost of that fracture.
Up to $30,000 in the case of a fractured hip. Hecht says the pilot program could expand to other parts of the country if it breaks even. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Investors broke to the upside. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Those hoping the housing market has hit bottom found out otherwise today. A pair of reports showed both sales and prices continue to fall, though they are getting worse more slowly. That's promising for buyers who hope to get in on the American dream of home ownership at bargain basement prices, a dream that remains elusive for some. And commentator Gustavo Arellano says it probably will for a while.
This September marks the 20th anniversary of my parents realizing the American dream. In 1989, they scraped together their tomato canner and truck driver salaries and bought a three-bedroom, two-bath, one-pool house in a nice Anaheim neighborhood. Soon, their friends did the same. My parents' generation of Mexicans came to this country with nothing, many of them illegally, my daddy in the trunk of a Chevy. Yet all of my uncles, aunts, and their middle-aged Mexican immigrant friends are secure homeowners. Me? I have a white-collar career, a master's degree from UCLA, and no debt or children, but I can barely pay the rent on my one-bedroom apartment. Many of my Latino peers still live at home or room with friends and will for the foreseeable future. We don't even have the option anymore, as we used to laughingly threaten, to move back to our ancestral Mexican villages. Gracias very mucho, drug cartels. So we're left with this fact. The immigrants of my parents' generation will better weather this recession than their educated, assimilated American kids. These older Mexicans aren't moving anywhere. They bought into the market when real estate was cheaper, when mortgages were affordable, and they make the payments. Layoffs don't mean much. Been there, done that, used cow chips as fuel in Mexico when times were truly tough. Even though my mother stopped working full-time a decade ago, and my father lost his trucking job last month, they're making it work. Mom cuts hair, dad cleans pools. She takes care of kitties, he mows lawns. have job opportunity, will show up 2 hours early. Me? I'm a newspaper reporter. We all know the stability of that industry. The generational gap couldn't be wider. My parents and their amigos came from an existence of nothing, an existence in which the sword of poverty dangled above families daily, teaching them to always prepare for the worst. My amigos and I, spoiled on the Reagan-era notion of faith in money, stand at the edge of economic despair, with few tools for coping other than witty Facebook status updates. Mom, Dad, and my tios y tias will survive. Me? That bunk bed I shared with my brother for 15 years is sure looking good.
Gustavo Arellano is a staff writer for the OC Weekly. He writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. You can write to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Like a lot of you, I spent my morning doing about five different things at once. Emailing, writing this show, making phone calls. My producer came in, my wife called, my producer came in again, and then again later. So there were some distractions. Everything got done eventually, but maybe not as well as if I'd been paying attention to just one thing at a time. That's exactly the point Winifred Gallagher makes in her new book, Wrapped: Attention and the Focused Life.
Attention is the brain's process of spotlighting the most compelling thing in your world, which could be a stop sign or a sudden feeling of jealousy, and suppressing all the competing stimuli. The good news is that by screening your experience, attention creates order from what would be potential chaos. But the bad news is that little piece of reality that you focus on is more fragmented and subjective than you think. So whether you're aware of it or not, your brain can only focus on one thing at a time.
But how is it possible in this world when truly there are so many things you have to pay attention to, not necessarily simultaneously, but in very quick order? How do you make order of that?
You have to prioritize. Multitasking is a total myth. You cannot do two even mildly skillful activities at the same time, except in very, very specific circumstances with a lot of training and a lot of drilling.
So if my producer's talking into my ear right now and I'm having a conversation with you at the same time, which one do I pay attention to?
You can't process them both, so you have to decide. You either have to put a silencer on your producer or you have to put me on hold. When you think you're doing two things at once, what you're really doing is switching back and forth between them, which actually takes longer and makes you inefficient, error-prone. We've all had that experience where we've tried to talk on the phone while we answer email, and we end up either forgetting who we called when they pick up, or we end up sending a disastrous email that we meant to hit forward, and instead we hit reply. So when you have something important that you need to do, an important piece of work, block off about 90 minutes, turn off your machines, do that work for 90 minutes, then get up and do something else. When you go back to your task, you'll approach it with a fresh mind, and you can answer your email and your phone calls at that 90-minute break.
Turning off the machines for 90 minutes is great, but in a lot of places, not this one, but in a lot of places, if you don't respond to your email quickly, if you don't answer that cell phone, you're out of a job.
That's true. And it's not a perfect world. And I think one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book was to try to help people see how important attention is, how finite it is. You have enough attention for 173 billion bits of information in your whole life. It's like money. It's like cognitive cash. And you've got to spend it carefully. And I think as a culture, we have to become more realistic. The same way we've gone through a banking mess and that's going to result in some new rules and regulations, I think we're going to have to go through a focusing crisis and just recalibrate how much we're actually able to do.
What are the other steps then? Once you've gotten your 90 minutes, what else do you do? Because it can't just be that easy as turning off the computer and closing the door.
Well, if your attention fades, have some coffee. Coffee actually is an attention booster. It works. Another good trick for fading attention is to refocus on your target or your task and try to notice new things about it. This is actually a tip from very creative people. Creative people don't just glance at something and move on. They look at it and notice stuff that doesn't seem important. Creative people engage and elaborate on what they're focused on. By engaging, you make things more interesting.
The book by Winifred Gallagher about paying attention, I suppose you could say, is called Wrapped. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Coming up, from ghost town to boom town to just trying to get by.
You know, sure, we're concerned, but now is the time to do. Now is the time to take the chance and to be ready when the economy comes back.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 70 points today, 0.9%, finished at 79.57. The NASDAQ inched up 6 points, 0.3%, closed at 16.52. The S&P 500 winched up 8 points, about 1%, ended things at 8.51. Financials were mostly up today. Wells Fargo led the way with a 10% gain. Bank of America was up 6.75. Car seller AutoNation revved up 10% despite a 32% drop in quarterly earnings. Chocolate maker Hershey rose 1.3% on the sweet news that profits were up 20% in the first quarter. Britain's FTSE and the French CAC 40 each fell by less than 1%. Germany's DAX fell 1.25%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.92%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Producemore, conservemore.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit Marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for March. A House Subcommittee on Energy and the Environment concludes 4 days of hearings on the American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009. And a day to plant trees, or sit in the shade of one and enjoy. Tomorrow is National Arbor Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Letter topic number one this week matches news topic number one, the banks. In a commentary about the TARP, the bank bailout, Robert Reich questioned whether or not the heads of the biggest banks in this country ought to be fired for mismanagement. He said taxpayers, who are now really shareholders, are entitled to some accountability. And then he said this.
Yes, I know. Wall Street needs all the talent it can find, and we don't want government bureaucrats running our banks. But we do need people who understand that when they take billions of dollars of public money, they have public responsibilities.
That's where a lot of you, like Robert Bruner in Detroit, said, hang on just a second, not about the public responsibility part, but about the government running our banks part.
He recited the well-worn formula, we don't want government bureaucrats running our banks. Given the competence of the FDIC crew that handles the failing banks, I, for one, would be glad to have someone so competent running our banks.
We brought you a story about e-readers last week. Sony makes one, Amazon.com too, but other companies are jumping into the market. Designs are being improved, but price tags aren't getting any lower. So Steve Bradford, for one, here in Los Angeles, still isn't sold.
I could use an e-reader for the several hundred pages of documentation that my work needs me to carry around when I'm on call. I could use it to read the L.A. Times and the Wall Street Journal, but not at $400.
Prices are also an issue for United Airlines. United has decided to charge overweight passengers for an extra seat if they're having trouble fitting into the one they paid for. Our story on that got a lot of responses, mostly along the lines of this one from Bill Fabry in Woodstock, New York.
Well, I have many friends who will be adversely affected by the policy due to their size, and they are not fat because they sit around eating Twinkies all day. People come in all shapes and sizes. You don't have to be all that large to spill over into the next sardine seating provided by the airline.
On the theory that turnabout is fair play, Bridget Disney of Omaha, Nebraska said United ought to be fair all the way around.
Tiny people use less space and fuel, so they should get a refund.
And finally, a terminology update. I've told you about our cliche wall here, right? Our running list of the most overused or laziest economic verbiage. Ken Pimple wrote from Bloomington, Indiana, with his pet peeve.
I'm starting to get tired of listening to people use the phrases toxic asset and bad asset, because if something is toxic or bad, it isn't an asset. It's a liability.
Send us your peeves if you got them. I know you do. The best way is by email, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Mesquite, Nevada sits right along the Arizona border, about an hour and a half northeast out of Las Vegas. Life there is laid back, and that's usually an attraction for gamblers and golfers and retirees. Lately, though, Mesquite's been way too quiet. Tourism is down a third from last year. The owner of three casinos in town is struggling to pay the bills. One resort has already gone dark, leaving hundreds out of work. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has been following the Mesquite story for a long time.
I've watched this place go from a tiny little town to a boom town, and now a town on the edge. It was right here on this spot, in fact, that I played my very first slot machine at the age of 5. I can still remember giggling as my grandfather lifted me within reach of a one-armed bandit. I also vividly recall the crabby waitress who rushed over to enforce the rules and spoil the fun as the slot machine poured out what to my wide eyes was a river of shimmering silver. Funny how childhood memories end up being bigger than life. Actually, way back then, Mesquite was hardly more than a tiny blink-and-you'll-miss-it refueling outpost in the desert. Its early Mormon settlers turned the bright red soil here green with alfalfa to supply their horse ranches. Later, slot machines were treated almost as an afterthought. At least that's how Alan Green remembers it. His father-in-law, Cy Red, took over a sleepy truck stop back in the early 1980s and discovered to his amazement that the previous owners didn't seem to think of gambling as part of their business plan.
Cy always thought it was kind of funny that when he bought it, it had 23 slot machines and only half of them worked. And he realized that they were such good Mormons they didn't want to see people gamble.
The modest property became a full-service resort called the Oasis. A rival developer named Merv Griffin built another resort across the street, and a third casino operator eventually bought control of all three properties. Then came a fourth resort. Alan Green, who ran the Oasis for several years, concedes the casino rush was dizzying.
Maybe too many, too fast. Oversaturation.
Suddenly, tiny Mesquite became Nevada's fastest-growing city, and for a time, the fastest-growing small town in America. In barely a decade, the population soared from a few hundred to nearly 20,000. And then, quicker than it came, the boom suddenly went bust, capping a ruinous year for the whole state's gaming and tourism business. Breathless Las Vegas newscasters reacted to the surprise mothballing of the Oasis Casino as if the whole community had just rolled snake eyes.
500 jobs at the Oasis will be cut.
The city is worried the layoffs will be disastrous.
In a small community like Mesquite that relies heavily on the casino industry, it creates fear citywide.
First, your stomach lurches.
That's Mesquite Mayor Susan Holacek.
You have this almost crushing sense. How are you going to be able to get these people into jobs, and how quickly can you do it?
The added worry in a small town like this is that the sudden loss of 500 jobs can fast lead to more layoffs. A Denny's restaurant worker named Laura, for example, only a week after the nearby casino shut down, she lost the job she had just found. She spoke to me through a caseworker at the local family services center.
Nomás trabajé la primera semana de diciembre.
You only worked the first week of December.
She was laid off just that quickly.
Sí, ya la siguiente, a la segunda semana ya no fue a trabajar más.
After the second week, she no longer was back to work. She was let go, laid off.
The deeply in-debt casino operator, Black Gaming, is still struggling to hold off creditors and keep its two remaining resorts in town going, and the company still hopes the Oasis can be saved. But when attorney Chris Kempfer went before a city council meeting representing the town's biggest single employer, he could offer no promises at all about the future.
Anybody who stands up here and gives you any kind of guarantees is doing themselves a disservice and you a disservice. And we will not and cannot do that because of the uncertainty and changing nature of this economy.
By now, you might imagine a city reeling in fear that it could end up becoming a modern-day Nevada ghost town. But the mayor insists you'd be as wrong as those naysayers who counted out the first settlers when flash floods washed them away.
The people who kept coming to Mesquite were the people who said, gosh darn it, we're going to keep trying.
And with that, the city's economic development director, Brian Dangerfield, takes me out to see Mesquite's own stimulus plan, heading over one of the city's three highway crossings.
This is kind of the middle connector, so you don't have to go from one end of town to next just to get over the freeway.
I remember when Mesquite used to have one connector.
Yeah, you're showing your age.
Dangerfield shows off the city's popular golf resorts and a sprawling Sun City retirement development that's forging ahead with strong sales.
Do you want to get out real quick?
Sure.
But it's this newly planned attraction the town's just landed that my tour guide hopes will bring even more visitors.
This Desert Falls project is every sports person's dream.
In the days after the big casino layoff, Mesquite saw the chance to catch a lucky break. The city just committed to selling a big block of land for a $500 million international sports training and tournament complex. Dangerfield envisions pro and amateur teams and athletes flocking to games, camps, and clinics. And he sees some even more immediate benefits in the construction jobs it'll be created. No matter that it's such a huge commitment at such an uncertain time.
You know, sure, we're concerned, but now is the time to take the chance and to be ready when the economy comes back.
Dangerfield says history shows those who stay in the game, even through tough times, come out ahead, so city leaders consider it a safe bet on their economic future. In Mesquite, Nevada, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Bob put together some slideshows of a little town that's trying to buck long odds. They're at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, ABC Television is trying to recapture its glory days from a decade ago. It's banking on Regis Philbin and a big pile of money to do it. And I would guess we're all going to get sick and tired of hearing this. 10 years ago, ABC gutted its primetime schedule for a new game show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? We all watched for a little while, until we tuned out. It took ABC a couple of years to get its primetime mojo back on track. They will revisit Millionaire in August for what they say is going to be an 11-day run. And yes, that is my final answer. Actually, no, it's not. I changed my mind. My final answer is, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 70 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ added 6 points. That's 0.3%. The S&P 500 hiked up 0.4% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, and Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, too, are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, putting money back into pension funds.
I think if we take a long view, and by long view I mean not 5 years, but 20 years, I think that we will smooth this out over time.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.